Will your anchor hold in the floods of death when the water's cold to your latest breath? On the rising tide, you can never fail while your anchor holds within the veil. Hymn number 11. Someone please start that.
Will your anchor hold in the storms of life when the flood of no bearing loves strife, when the strong tides lift and the cables stretch, will your anchor ever
something on that table on the way up, which most of you can't see, but some can, and maybe you can peer over the head and see it. And I'll have to explain a little bit about what that is, and you can take a look at it later. It's the object lesson for tonight. So I'll read the first verse, and maybe you'll understand why. You know what the first verse is. All of you probably know where it is. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. This is probably one of the things that is under attack today. What I have there on our trip out here from the east, we went through somewhere in deepest, darkest Massachusetts on Highway 2 and stopped for dinner along the way. And in the table next to us, there was a couple there that we started to kind of engage in conversation. They seemed pretty friendly. And it was a man and his wife, and she began to talk about Clear Lake, which is a region down by Houston, where Patty's brother lives near there. And Patty said, "Oh, I have a brother that lives in near there in Alvin." And they knew where that was. And the conversation pursued. And she had worked at the space center there and was an astronaut. Katie Coleman was her name, and her husband, Josh Simpson. And so one of the fellows in the astronaut program had gone to the same Presbyterian church that Patty's brother goes to. And so Patty had met this person at a function that was for her nephew there when we were there. And they were there, Dave Hilmer and his wife. So she dropped that name, and of course Katie knew them. And as the conversation began to die down, we asked them, we were eating dinner there, we didn't see a hotel, and we were ready to hole up for the night. And they said they didn't know of any in the area. It's a small town. But we happen to have a guest cottage, and it's all made up. The sheets are fresh, and you would be welcome to use it. This was an unusual situation. But we went ahead on over there and found that his job as an artist, so Patty connected with that as an artist, but his job is as a glass blower, and he would make these artifacts out of glass. And he had bought a barn there. It was a large barn, and he went to work there probably 30 years ago in his trade. He's probably in his late 50s. And he makes these, you've probably seen them at the gift shop. Some are about the size of a bowling ball, and they're made out of glass, and that you can set them on the table. They have a flat bottom, and you can look at them and be amazed. And your friends will come, and visitors, and they will look at them and be amazed. And you've got a conversation piece there going for you. So he sells these at a pretty good clip. He's probably number 3 or 4 glass maker in the world. So as we stayed there, we had the opportunity the next day. He was being interviewed by a magazine, name I forgot, but the reporters were there, 4 of them, and they were taking pictures of him in his activity there, making these ornaments. This is a little one that he gave us as a souvenir, but as I say, some of them are the size of a bowling ball, weigh about 90 pounds. And they're very ornamental. And the way he does this, he has this long rod, a little bigger around than this, about 6 or 7 feet long, and it's made out of metal. And he has these furnaces there that go all the time, huge furnaces, doors on them, and they're fed by propane gas. He has a 3,000-gallon propane tank buried out in his lawn. He fills it 3 or 4 times a year for his business. So he's got these 4 or 5 large furnaces going, and you open the door, and you stick that stick in there, and you twirl around a little bit, and out comes a little blob of molten glass on the end of it. And so they take that over to a stand and put this stick on some props, and one guy is turning it, and he's standing there with a cup made out of oak that's dipped in water, and he takes the cup and puts it up under this molten glass while the guy is spinning it so that it takes a round form. Otherwise, it kind of melts on him and falls over, so he's able to form it this way. Now, there's a lot that goes into this. There's a reason why I'm telling you all this, so don't go away yet. He does this about 4 or 5 times. He doesn't put it in there and bring out a blob of glass that's the size of a bowling ball. He works up to it, layer upon layer upon layer. So as he brings a layer, his project out of the kiln, and I ask him about that, the kiln is about as wide open as the top of this podium, and it has a door that slides shut, so one of the helpers opens it, and he sticks the pole in there into this molten glass, and he gets his supply of glass, and he starts to take it out, and they close it back up, and then they go to work on it. I ask him, what happens when you hit the side of that kiln? Does it shatter? He says, no. It sticks to the door, whatever you hit, so tight you can't get it off and you lose your project. So it's a delicate operation. It's a very technical operation. It's a detailed operation. And he's doing this 4 or 5 times to get one the size of a bowling ball. And then when he brings this thing out, after he has a few layers there, the thing is maybe this big, and he'll take from his table where he has a tray there with different colored glass that's stretched out to about the size, a little bigger than a pencil lead, a large pencil lead. A small pencil, a large pencil lead, you know, right about in that area. And the glasses, the little pieces of glass that he have there are different colors. So he picks up his tweezers and the glass is hot. He has them probably at 500 degrees, and he picks it up and he pokes it on that thing, and it sticks there. And he'll take a little score, a razor, and he'll streak it like this at different places and gets different designs on it. And these different things that he can put in there. And you will see that as you look at that close up. Only this at a bowling ball size is largely magnified over what we have there, but you'll get the idea. Now, what I'm saying in all of this is there is a lot of detail and forethought that goes into making one of these things. It is not the result of an explosion in a volcano that it just pops out and lands this way. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. This first statement that God gives us is primarily under attack. First of all, they used to think that the universe was eternal and it went all the way back. That's what they taught me in college in the 60s. That was before the Big Bang idea, when everything started from a point of singularity and all the laws of nature break down and there's no particles and there's no law, there's no nothing. And then you had this big explosion and the universe pops out of that. And they sat there scratching their head wondering what they're going to do about that, because that requires some kind of a prime mover to make this happen. They can't count on particles and laws of nature going all the way back anymore. I'm talking about these people who will pawn off on you, especially you college students, these ideas of metaphysical naturalism, that is, metaphysical, the broad idea of how everything is, naturalism, how we get what we've got. How did this come about? And they're going to try to explain it on a purely naturalistic basis so that they do not allow God to get his foot in the door. Now, I've been to college and I've heard this, so I know this happens. I remember in a geography class in about 1964, when I was taking a geography class at Chico State in Northern California, this professor stood there, leaned on his podium with all this hubris he can muster, and he says, God is an idea in the mind of man. Evolution is a fact. And he said it with such hubris, and I wasn't saved, and I didn't challenge him, and I thought, my, I wonder if that's so. I didn't know any better at that time. And I didn't know how to challenge the concept. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. If the universe goes all the way back through cause and effect, you have what is called an infinite regress, because it takes energy to have cause and effect, and you're going to run out of energy. So what is supplying the energy in this infinite regress all the way back of cause and effect, all the way back, into eternity, never stopping? Where do you get the energy to support that? Now, with the Big Bang idea, where do you get the matter to work with? Where do you get the material to work with? We have the answer to that in this singular, succinct statement. But a lot comes with it. In the beginning, God created the heavens. How far does that go? The heavens, plural. How far out does it go? Hubble takes a look out there, looks as far as it can't find the end of it. But what it does find is things banging into each other and flames and explosions. It's hard to imagine the effect that sin has had on the whole creation. And you can read about that in the 8th chapter of Romans, that the whole show groans and travails under this weight of sin. He has sent His Son to restore that which He took not away. He has delegated to the Son the whole process of creation. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And the Word was God. And all things were created by Him, and not anything that was made was not created in any other way than by Him. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. God has a project going here. In this concept of creating something or making something, as we look at this as a man, perhaps I want to build a house. Perhaps Henry Ford wanted to build a car. Perhaps somebody wanted to build an airplane. This begins as an idea in an intelligent being. We'll call that the formal cause, because the Greeks called it that. It's an initial consideration by an omnipotent being able to bring about what He has in mind. God had this in mind in eternity past. This is no second guess or makeup project. He is the formal cause. To get something in operation that is in the thoughts, there are several things that you need. You need a material cause. So, if the Greeks are going to build a trireme to go out and fight the Medes and Persians, they've got to have some wood. And they have to have enough of it to make their trireme that they can put 70 or 80 soldiers on so that they can go up and drop the plank on the Persian boats and storm the boat and win the battle. They've got this all thought out. But more than a formal cause, they have to have a material cause. They have to have the material for this thing to do it. So they go out and cut down a bunch of trees and go at it. Then they need an efficient cause. Somebody has to put this together. You can't leave the pile of wood out there and expect it to do its thing. Somebody has to give it a hand. So the carpenter comes and he hacks. And all these people, the navigators and the sailors, they come and they put this thing together. That's the efficient cause. The final cause. There are four reasons. Formal, material, efficient, and final cause. To get something from out of the mind into existence. The final cause is that for which they have intended. And the final cause is to put this thing to work to defeat the Medes and Persians in the case of the Greeks and the Medes and Persians. Henry Ford's idea was to get something to go down the road and give us transport. Somebody built an airplane to get us there faster. That's how it works without exception. So it won't do to say that the whole universe just came out of nothing. It never works that way. Nothing ever works that way. Another case for the creation. Why am I going into this so long? I know that you young people going to college are facing these issues just as I was 50 years ago. They haven't changed. In this world that we live in, there are the what is called anthropic principles that are in play in order for life as we know it to exist here. All the details that we observe in the universe, where our Earth is. My very energetic mother. Earth is the third guy out. Third one out in the solar system. That's important. Not too hot, not too cold. The Earth is tilted 23.5 degrees on an axis. Important. Gives us seasons. It spins at a certain rate. So that one side doesn't get baked and the other side get frozen. So we have night and day. It goes around the sun at a consistent and predictable way. So again, that we have seasons. All of these things its position in the universe, the moon that we have, the two planets that are outside of us that are out there running interference, running into asteroids so that we don't. The whole show is in a convulsion. But God preserves by His own loving hand a situation here upon which He puts those that are created in His likeness and His image. Likeness to commune. Image to represent. Ask yourself right now, how are you doing? When's the last time you spoke to God and how did you do it? Throw me a bone. Get me out of this so I can go on and do something else. And if I get in trouble again, I'll give you a call. This is the flippant attitude of the unbeliever who's never bowed the knee in repentance toward God and faith in Jesus Christ. And they go on that way all the way through their lives in a mockery and a hypocrisy. In this, said likeness and image, likeness to commune, we can do that. Image to represent. In this communion, when you pray, it's intelligent using words. Jesus is known in John chapter 1 as the Word, the expression of God. Have you ever thought about how language plays out? In language, in order for this communicating, opposable, digited, upright standing, morally conscious, God-conscious being we call man, different than every other creature that God made, likeness and image, you can't attribute that to a chimpanzee or a monkey or a gorilla. This thing about language, there are three things that are necessary for us to have this conversation that we're having right now, for you to have a conversation with your brother or sister or mother or father or friend at school. In language, there are three necessary things: complexity, a selectivity, and an aperiodic material to work with. In the complexity, in our language, we have 26 little things that you see written on your page there, and we call it an alphabet. This is the complexity. Just two letters won't do. What if we had just a B and an A? We would sound like the Babylonians, ba, 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 ba. And he confused the language and called it Babylon. And we still use the word today. We need more than just two or three in this complexity. We have 26 in our language that we use in different forms, and each one has an assigned sound to it. This is complex. Well, there they are, 26 letters. Do we reach down and grab a handful and throw them on the page? Will that make any sense? No, it won't. It gets worse. We have to have a selective process so that the author of a book, War and Peace, Tolstoy, takes down, he grabs some, and he puts them here, just the right ones, and he forms words which form sentences, which form paragraphs, which form chapters, which forms the grand story. And only the human being is capable of this process. This is so intricate, that it could not have worked its way up through the evolutionary process. The third one is, it has to be aperiodic. You just, again, cannot, in your selection and complexity, you select the ones you want out of the complexity you have at hand, and then in an aperiodic way, you put them together. Aperiodic means that it's not just a standard, repetitious way, like I said, to be a Babylon idea. So, if we look at our first statement, N-I-N, the, T-H-E. This didn't get there by accident. It's a very complex thing, and the fellow named Noam Chomsky, who's the hero of language studies in the scientific field, looked at that as he came up with this. He said, I just don't see, and he's not a believer. He says, I don't see how this could have worked its way up through the evolutionary system. This is too intricate. Think of what we're doing here. I'm making these statements, I'm finishing these sentences, and you're taking them in and you're hearing. This is not Polly Wants a Cracker. You can train a parrot to to say that. But that's not communication. And Polly doesn't even know what she's saying. But she can be trained to say that. And that is a unique critter anyway. And all she can get out of it is Polly wants a cracker and doesn't know what she said. She's saying it by rote. What we're doing is so far beyond that, that it almost defies description, especially in the slow process, the slow process, and the billions of years that is needed to get from zero to where we are. And they used to figure that the universe was about 22 billion years old, and the Earth maybe 12. And now the universe is about 12 billion years old, and the Earth about 6 billion years old. And most of those fellows are scratching their head thinking, we cannot go from zero to upright, articulating man in 6 billion years. We need more time than that. The process doesn't work that fast. The whole trick to it is to hide it behind so much time you can't comprehend it. Okay. We've got in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and it's the first statement that He made, and I've spent a bit of time on that, almost half of our time, because that is the thing under challenge in today's culture, especially in Western and educated civilizations, European and American and Russian. Let's go to the end of Genesis. Chapter 50. We had in the beginning, rather than go through each chapter and give the salient points of each one, you know that He created man in His likeness and image, and it didn't take Him very long to fall from both, to violate both. We call it sin. It's disobedience. They did what God told them not to do. And they didn't have a very wide range of opportunities to do what God told them not to do. But they did it anyway. Because Satan was more subtle than any beast of the field. There are consequences. Now we've got quite a few people on the earth when we get to the end of Genesis chapter 50. And we read that Joseph died. This is Genesis 50:26. He died. You go back to, I think it's chapter 5, it's the obituary column. And everyone there, so-and-so lived so many years, and he died. And he died. And he died. And the wages of sin is death. And Joseph died. 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. And the book starts with such possibilities and ends in a coffin in Egypt. And that is the destination of each one of us, unless the Lord comes first. And it is the destination of each one without the Lord. And the wages of sin is death. And the ratio is still 1:1. And there is no escape apart from the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. The provision that God has made in great love to each one of us. And you will realize your need as you go along in a place of independence and self-will. It will catch up with you. It's a painful life to leave the Lord out. It's a blessed life to bring Him in. That doesn't mean that trials don't happen to believers. Of course they do. We live in the same scene. But we are spared so many of those diseases of Egypt that are prevalent today. Divorces, broken relationships, different kinds of diseases of the body from illicit activities, accidents that perhaps leave us maimed for the rest of our lives through inebriation and driving, sclerosis of the liver and excesses of drunkenness. All of these things are the diseases of Egypt. And believers, He spares from those things. Because we know that they're an interference between us and the one who bought us with His precious blood. Now we'll go to Psalm 1:18. And look at the very middle verse of the Bible. We have covered but not exhausted Genesis. We skipped over a few words, huh? And get to the very middle verse of the Bible, Psalm 118. I'll read verses 8 and 9. It is better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in man. It is better to trust in the Lord to put confidence in princes. Where is your confidence going to be when you're in extremis? One day about 20 years ago, I guess. See, my son is 42. He's over 20 years ago. He's about 18 at the time. We got a phone call at home from the neighbor. And they said, this guy just showed up at our house. He's soaking wet. He hiked all the way across the field. He's exhausted. He's on his last leg. He said he was coming down the river in a canoe. And he hit a snag and he capsized. And it's swift and it's cold and his wife is there on the log upon which they capsized and she is hanging on for dear life. And we need help. And the neighbor he finally got to, he didn't know where he was. He just carted off across the field, plowed field, and ran probably, at least a mile through this plowed field. Besought the neighbor with his plea. The neighbor called us because he knew that we lived right on the river and had a boat. So my son was home and we went down and we got in the boat and turned on the engine and started going to where they are, which was only about 300 yards up from where I live. It's a river and there's a current. It's a wide river, wider than this gem, and deep enough to run a boat in. But you have to watch where you're going because there are snags and sandbars. And here's this gal hanging on to this log about this big around that had floated down there and jammed in the soil in the river and sticking up as a snag on which they had capsized. And he had gotten to shore and the shore was probably 20 yards away for her and it was swift and it was cold and she was exhausted. There was no way that she could get to the shore. She needed a rescue. It is better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in man. It is better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in princes. What I'm going to tell you is a story that is a similitude. Hosea says, I have also spoken unto you in similitudes. So if he can do that, I will follow suit. It's a good example. We went out there and got up from about here to that lampstand from where she was, and we're in the boat. And we're trying to decide just how to go about this so that we don't hit the snag and capsize her or crush her leg. Wanted to be safe. What are the options? We could get off maybe 10 yards. That'd be safe. I could say, jump in and swim over here. She couldn't have done it. She would have drowned in the process. Her only hope was we had to get right up there, risk hitting the snag, get right up here, face the current going upstream because it was a swift current, so we could stay there in position. We got right to where she was, right ahead of her. I turned around and said, hop in. She couldn't do it. She was clinging to that and didn't have the strength to let go, get a leg in the boat and get herself in. So my son, 18, stout, He puts out his arms, and he holds her a good grip and gets her, pulls her all the way into the boat. Now you see where this similitude is going. Christ comes right to where we are. He became a man. He dwelt among us. There's no use giving us 10 commandments. That's like telling her to hop in the river and swim to where I am, and if you make it, you're saved. We are not up for 10 commandments. We're not up for law, any kind of law that we might invent for ourselves, thinking that God will accept what we do and overlook the rest that we shouldn't have done. After all, God must be gracious. This is the way He made me. Here am I. What else can I do? And to misrepresent God, for God is holy and He cannot overlook sin. So He took His own beloved Son, and you can get this in Romans chapter 3, and He He sends them here right to where we are. And he was rejected. He came unto his own received him not. He goes to the Gentiles. He's taken. He is stripped of his clothing. He is spit upon. He is unjustly tried. That's man's thoughts and his reaction to the absolutely pure, sinless one who comes from God, who is the creator of all things. And man meets his creator and he pushes him away. Are you still doing that? You would be no less guilty than those that were there at that time. You say, well, if I were there, I wouldn't have done that. If you're pushing him away now, you would have pushed him away then. This is a moral issue. He allowed that to happen. He goes to Calvary's cross. They mount him on a Roman gibbet. They mock him. They spit upon him. And leave him there and say, if he is the Son of God, let God save him. And they depart. And God closes the scene with a midday darkness as he pours out his judgment that was due to me for all my sins. And the way that I have responded to God for the first 22 years of my life, and all sins after that as well. They were placed on Him, and He bore them in my stead. We have a substitute. But if you will not receive the substitute, you will die in your own sins and be judged for your own sins. You will take the responsibility fully upon yourself and never be able to pay the price. The wicked shall be silent in darkness. There is no more controversy. And yet they will still be shaking their fist in enmity at God. There is no repentance in hell. There is no change of heart in hell. This is the day of salvation. This is the day that He has spoken, and He waits in patience. We'll go to Revelation chapter 22. I just want to mention there in Matthew chapter 1, the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. As we start the New Testament, the old ends in a curse. Man set aside, seen to be irresponsible. Now God provides in pure grace. So we get in the New Testament the introduction of the man of peace, the Holy One. We go to the end of the book. What does it say? The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you all. Amen. The grace, it's pure grace. There is nothing that we could do, so God did. And He spared not His only beloved begotten Son, the bosom, the darling of His bosom, the Eternal One, in communion in the Godhead in eternity past, in perfect harmony, without discord, perfect communion, full of grace, full of truth. Now, justifying God as to the question as to why does He allow sin? Why has He put up with it? He has provided an offering that suits Himself so that He is just in justifying the ungodly that will come to Him. He is just in doing this. He is sweeping nothing under that rug. Nothing that you have done. All is exposed and laid upon Him when you come to Him for the Savior. And God, therefore, is just. He has dealt with the sin issue that has separated us from Him. He has met it according to His own standards. The provision is entirely His. One more story and I'll close. And the story is, I use it as an illustration of the desperation of our position and the provision that comes outside of ourselves. When I was in my 20s, I went into naval aviation. I was just out of college. I was going to be drafted. I had no option. I thought I would make the best of the deal. And went down and applied at the Navy recruiter to go into naval aviation. I couldn't see well enough to be a pilot, but I could see well enough with glasses to be a navigator. So my billet was that I flew in the back of F-4s for two cruises over in Vietnam. Several hundred combat missions over North Vietnam, Laos, and South Vietnam. Carrier based. One day, I was flying with a fellow named John Paget, who had gone through the Naval Academy, and we always flew in sections, two airplanes. In the other airplane was Herb Wheeler, who had gotten his commission through OCS, and he was about 3 months junior to the pilot I was flying with named John. So Herb's our wingman, because the senior pilot is the lead pilot. I'm explaining all this because it's part of the story. In the back seat of each of these two aircrafts, I'm in one, Jim Benninger is in the other one. Jim was a history major and went to college somewhere in Pennsylvania. There was a target down there, I think it was a plant. It was the daytime. We never saw trucks in the daytime along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They hid everything under the bushes. You didn't see troops. You didn't see movement. They moved at night. Here was this truck. It was a daytime hop. And we were vectored to this truck. We looked at it down there. We come in at about 30,000 feet. Yep, this truck down there, bright as can be, sitting there. It was either broke down or it was a plant. Because my pilot was senior to the other crew, we went in first. We come in at 30,000 feet, put it at 45 degrees, build the airspeed to 450 knots, come down, get the pipper on the target, that's the sight, it's in the pilot seat, on the target. We meet all those parameters, you release at a certain altitude, and physics takes care of the rest. We rolled in, dropped our bombs, pulled off at about 2,000 feet above ground level, not above sea level. These are our parameters. Less apt to be hit by ground fire. We pull off. We're coming back around. And I look back to see Herb and Jim coming in. And they were in a spin. They'd lost control. They were in a spin. The reason they lost control is that they had taken a hit and it had damaged their controls. It takes 10,000 feet for a healthy F-4 to pull out of a spin. They were down around 4,000 feet. No possible way. Pretty soon I saw the plane hit the ground, blow up in a big explosion. Herb and Jim. Then I saw two good parachutes. They had waited to the last because they were hoping to pull that out rather than land down there and be captured. Two good parachutes. It was Herb's lot to land in a clump of trees. We'll say this. These mats here, the little forest of trees, a clump of them, and he lit right in there, let himself down to the ground, and hid there. There were Vietnamese troops all over the place. Jim, there's a road over here, that's that blue line. He lands on this side of the road about 300 yards from where Herb landed. And that's an open field, and nowhere to hide. And there's his parachute, and we are up here at 10,000 feet watching all this. We carry a PR2 radio on ourselves. If we punch out, we can talk to somebody on the guard channel. We have communication with them from down there on the ground to our aircraft at 10,000 feet. There's Jim down there with his parachute, an orange section, a white section, an orange section, and a white section all the way around. And here are the troops up here on the hill, and they're starting to come down. The first thing I did was call a helicopter. to come and rescue Herb and Jim. They can't walk out. They can't evade. Time is the essence. They're going to be captured if they stay there. Herb was somewhat hidden. Jim was out in the open. We're waiting for the helicopter to come. It takes about an hour. They don't park the helicopters right next to the bomb site. They're over in friendly territory that they can protect. They got to come about 70 miles, 75 miles. It takes the crew a little time to run out there, jump in, get turned up, and fly at about 170 miles an hour to the designated need where they were, their destination. As the helicopter is coming, Jim says, "I see some troops coming at me from a distance there. We're out of bombs. Navy F-4 doesn't carry guns. We have no munitions." But we knew that they didn't know that. So we came down out of 10,000 feet to about 1,000 feet AGL. And we were motoring right along. And an F-4, probably 750 miles an hour. At that low altitude, it's a fast-moving target. Went right over the top of Jim and headed for the direction where he said they were coming. It's a bluff. Flew right over the top of them. They probably just had enough time to